and also to Ashraf Hayat for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be back here again after a couple of years, I think. And thank you all very much for coming. Well, the first part of my remarks will not be so cheerful, the later part, I hope, more so. It does seem that amidst a rapidly changing Asia, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, regional relations in this part of the world appear generally frozen or stagnant, and not, of course, in the best of ways. As Ashraf remarked, I was recently in Afghanistan twice in recent months, partly for research, partly to chair this Track 2 dialogue between unofficial Afghan and Pakistani representatives, backed by the British Foreign Office and organised at this end by Mr. Imtiaz Gul, who will be known to most of you. And I think that the formation of this Track 2 initiative, Beyond Boundaries, reflected the really considerable hopes that were raised by the election of Ashraf Ghani in Afghanistan, and his real desire, I think, his genuine commitment to try to improve relations with Pakistan as part, of course, of an effort eventually to bring peace in Afghanistan. Well, as we heard from Humayun Khan, very little, unfortunately, very, very little, has so far come of this. The quadrilateral group process is, it seems, suspended. The Afghan Taliban have pulled out of talks for the moment. And Afghan-Pakistani relations are also, to a great extent, frozen. The reasons for this are multiple. There is, of course, a legacy of deep distrust between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and with blame on both sides. There is an Afghan nationalism which I've found to be largely structured around anti-Pakistan feeling in ways perhaps somewhat similar to the way that Pakistani nationalism has become structured around anti-Indian feeling, and even Indian nationalism around anti-Pakistan feeling. Above all, of course, there was the exaggerated expectation in Afghanistan that Pakistan could deliver the Afghan Taliban to the negotiating table. Now, I still think that, in principle, Pakistan can deliver the Afghan Taliban to the negotiating table, but, of course, ultimately there is no point in such a process unless there is the beginnings, some kind of basis for an eventual peace settlement on the table. Because without that, I mean, one could talk for the next 200, 300, 500 years and not get anywhere. And, of course, that offer has to come, as everyone agrees, from Kabul, from the government in Kabul. Now, that does not mean that Kabul could or should or will produce a peace settlement which then can lead to peace immediately. These processes, I'm afraid, if the example of Northern Ireland is anything to go by, even when the contours of an eventual peace settlement are entirely clear, usually take a very, very long time to come about. In the case of Northern Ireland, in my own country, Britain, the basic contours of the eventual Northern Irish peace agreement were already apparent in the early 1970s. Perfectly obvious, you know, what the eventual settlement would have to look like in terms of compromises by both sides. It took 25 years of fighting and terrorism for both sides to be, frankly, sufficiently exhausted and convinced that their maximal goals were not attainable for them eventually to come round to a settlement which, as I've said, had been on the table essentially for a whole generation. But, clearly, by the same token, it is necessary to start setting out the groundwork for this, or even in a generation, there will be no peace. And here there are two great problems. The first is that, well, The first, obviously, is that there is no offer. A key reason for that is not just that clearly to bring the government of, in Afghanistan and the Afghan state to a compromise with the Taliban would require enormous sacrifices on the part of many people within that state and indeed of state power, which they are not yet prepared to make. But there is an additional problem at the moment, which is that, as we have heard, the government in Kabul is deeply divided, even more divided, shall we say, than has been the case ever since it was put into place in 2001. Because, of course, of the power-sharing agreement between Dr. Ghani and Mr. Abdullah, which resolved the political crisis that followed the last disputed elections. And I'm afraid that my impression, but what everybody in Kabul has been saying to me, whether Afghans themselves or Westerners present, is that the Afghan government today is to a considerable extent paralyzed by its internal divisions, where the point, to the point where it is highly doubtful that it even could come up with even the beginnings of a peace settlement. On the other hand, of course, the Taliban is making progress on the ground, although I have to say, probably not as much as they themselves had hoped to make by now, or than many military analysts and people within within the Kabul government, from what I've heard, had expected them to make. And a key reason, the key reason for this, is that the United States, the Obama administration, have reversed their previous commitment to withdraw U.S. air power and U.S. forces from Afghanistan. And my sense is that on the purely military front, as long as the United States maintains air cover for the Afghan National Army, one may well, and of course all the other special forces, and goes on funding and supplying the Afghan National Army, we may well see a situation akin to that which followed the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan at the start of 1989, whereby, at which time I was travelling with the Afghan Mujahideen, I witnessed the Battle of Jalalabad in March 89, and then later I was able to go to the government side in Afghanistan. And what happened, of course, was that despite confident expectations of Western observers, of the Mujahideen themselves, of me, I'm ashamed to say, the Afghan state did not, in fact, collapse in the face of the Mujahideen. The Mujahideen overran the greater part of the Afghan countryside, but were for several years beaten back by superior firepower and discipline when they tried to take cities and major defended positions. And if present patterns continue, I think we may see that into the future. A different question, and one which raises great concern in Kabul and among many observers, is whether the political situation in Kabul will hold together in future. Whether the existing power-sharing agreement, contrary to the terms under which it was created, can simply be kicked down the line until the next elections. And if so, what happens at the next elections? But certainly at the moment, there does not seem to be the basis for an Afghan peace process. And certainly what I have heard on the Pakistani side is that while Pakistan can bring influence to bear on the Taliban to participate in peace talks, it cannot and will not try to force the Taliban to accept a peace settlement, which is unacceptable to the great majority of the Afghan Taliban, because, of course, that would simply lead to the Taliban split. It wouldn't lead to peace, it would lead to the Taliban splitting, and the greater part of the Taliban then continuing the war, but simultaneously continuing the war against Pakistan. And, of course, the appearance of ISIS in Afghanistan raises the threat to Pakistan from this point of view even further. Now, I think what many of us had hoped was that even, given this frozen situation of the Afghan peace process, that it might be nonetheless possible to improve relations between the Afghan and the Pakistani states in the area of trade and economic cooperation. Here, perhaps Pakistan could have done more to facilitate Afghan trade via Karachi. Of course, there are major problems about this to do with smuggling and the way in which Afghan trade is then tax-free Afghan trade is then diverted to sail within Pakistan. But I would certainly hope that this is an area where relations might be improved. Part of the problem here, though, is that it seems to me that basically the Afghans are asking for two things while only offering one. That is to say that they are offering Pakistan greatly improved transit to Central Asia through Afghanistan. They are asking in return both greatly improved transit for Afghanistan through Karachi, but also transit to India through Pakistan. Now, this latter demand, of course, then raises the whole question of Pakistani anxieties concerning India's role in Afghanistan, which brings me, of course, to relations with India. It seems to me highly doubtful, after recent visits to India as well, whether in Pakistan or India at the moment there is sufficient ability or will to try for a serious improvement of relations, let alone a renewed process to try to achieve a real settlement between them. The kind of process which, as we heard, was initiated by under President Musharraf, but which, of course, was not allowed to go to full term because of long hesitation on the Indian side and then the fall of the Musharraf government. On the Indian side, Mr. Modi has taken certain encouraging steps, personally. But certainly, you know, if you look at the attitudes of many people within his government, within his party, and within the Indian media, there is clearly intense hostility to Pakistan and suspicion of Pakistan. Especially, of course, questions about the continued role of Pakistani intelligence. It does seem to me, however, that there is a real will in the governments of both Pakistan and Afghanistan, not universal certainly, but nonetheless real, not to escalate present tensions and problems. In other words, to keep difficulties within restraints, to dampen down possible incidents of crisis. And I think we did see that to some extent, for example, in the Indian response to the Pathankot attack, which one can imagine could have been very much worse. So the best that can be hoped for, perhaps, is not to allow relations to deteriorate again. Now, in principle, such a relationship of, shall we say, frozen geopolitical hostility does not, need not in itself prove an insuperable obstacle to improve trade, economic relations, energy cooperation, and so on. And in this regard, I often point to two great examples of this in the world. One was Europe and the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 1980s, where, it must be said, in the face of very considerable opposition from the United States, the Soviet Union and Europe agreed to build what I think is still by far the largest system of energy infrastructure in the world, which delivers Russian gas from Siberia to Europe. And it's worth remembering that this was created not just during the Cold War, but in the depths of the Cold War, and it went on being constructed during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which tells you something. And despite certain subsequent problems, above all to do with what has happened in Ukraine or previous policies of Ukraine, it has gone on supplying Russian gas to this day. The other great contemporary example is East Asia, where you have, of course, a series of really pretty dangerous territorial disputes over these islands in the East China and South China Sea. Disputes which in turn reflect old and bitter hostilities between some of the countries of the region, especially China and Japan and China and Vietnam. Rather strikingly, once again, these deep hostilities, which have raised serious concerns among observers of the possible future conflicts involving the United States, have not prevented colossal trade and investment between these countries in East Asia, between all of them, including, by the way, remarkably enough, between Taiwan and China, two countries which, of course, do not recognize each other diplomatically. Now, what is the difference between this and the situation in South Asia, where, as has often been pointed out, levels of intra-regional trade and investment are the lowest in the world, the lowest of any major region in the world? Well, there are economic reasons for this, to do with the structures of the economies in the region, which are unfortunately not really in a position to help each other as the East Asian economies were, or not to nearly the same extent. But I think there is another factor to be kept in mind. Trade and cooperation can survive and even flourish in circumstances of geopolitical disputes between states. What they probably cannot survive is a situation of proxy warfare, and in which, or if it's not proxy warfare, a situation in which third parties, not in fact under full control of the states, have the ability to wreck relations by independent actions. As we have seen, obviously, in terrorist attacks against India, but as we have also seen, as is generally believed here, and for which there is some evidence, in Indian support for the Baloch rebels, for example. Very difficult to see how the confidence necessary for a real development of South Asian trade, including Afghan trade, can take place in these circumstances. And so I would, as I've said, not just me, as a great many people have said over the years, the countries of the region, India and Pakistan, Afghanistan, if it is doing it, need to move away from this past model and at all costs prevent further attacks of this kind by people who are or could be seen as proxies. Now, this brings me to the final part of my talk, which is more encouraging. It is particularly necessary that this should be so from Pakistan's point of view, because Pakistan today, I believe, has the best chance in 50 years, in 51 years to be precise, since the 1965 war, which essentially disabled government of President Ayub Khan, to try once again for a real breakthrough in terms of economic development in this country. And that, of course, is because of the Chinese offer of massive investment for transport infrastructure, energy infrastructure, and other things surrounding that. The amount of money involved is, of course, huge. The amount of money promised at $48 billion. And a general calculus among people who work in the area of development and economics is that if you have an input of that scale, you can look at this generating additional investment and economic growth at a rate of 3 or even 4 times that. So the question is, two enormous ifs. If this money is in fact made available, and if Pakistan, the Pakistani state, is capable of implementing it in an effective and efficient way. Certainly, however, for this. It would be, to put it mildly, very helpful if the security situation in and around Pakistan and the image of the security situation in Pakistan can be improved. Of course, Pakistan has made very serious commitments to the security of the Chinese route, but you know, it's not just a question of the route, the whole surrounding security situation also needs to be improved. And certainly from that point of view, from everything that I've heard, the Chinese, while of course being extremely cautious and concerned about India in the long run as a potential or increasingly actual ally of the United States against China, certainly do not at present favour any kind of new major crisis in South Asia. Any such crisis would, I think, or could seriously disrupt their plans and hopes for Pakistan. From this point of view also, I've said this, I think, I hope and believe that there is a real consensus here, thank God, in Pakistan. But especially coming as I do now from the Middle East, I cannot emphasize sufficiently how important it is for Pakistan to remain aloof from the sectarian conflicts and the proxy warfare now racking the Middle East. There have been now four terrible examples of what happens to countries, you know, which do not resolve or contain their sectarian differences, and, you know, which become structured along sectarian lines. Four states, some of which, you know, used to seem much stronger than Pakistan, have now collapsed into appalling conflict. A conflict, of course, fueled in several cases by proxy warfare between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Pakistan has every possible vital interest in not becoming involved in these conflicts. And certainly, once again, this would not be favoured in Beijing by the people who are planning CPAC. And, you know, from that point of view also, it's worth, you know, pointing out that after all this talk in recent years, by some Pakistanis, I'm sorry to say, as well as by Western observers, of Pakistan being a failed state, you know, Pakistan being on the brink of collapse, Pakistan is still here. A number of other states aren't. You know, let's make sure it continues to be here. You know? If the CPAC route can be developed, if Pakistan can be fully plugged into the One Belt, One Road plans of China, then it's not just that this hopefully could contribute to transforming Pakistan's own economy for a whole set of reasons, including, I mean, if this leads to energy security in Pakistan, the lack of which has done such damage to Pakistani economic growth and industry, and indeed to the confidence of ordinary people in the Pakistani state. But I think also that if this infrastructure can be created, and especially if in future it can be extended through Pakistan to Iran overland, then Pakistan will not just itself be a transport and communications hub, but it will be in a position to offer to Afghanistan and India, and indeed indirectly to states beyond that, to plug into a system of regional connectivity which is already in place. In other words, this will not be something that has to be created from scratch, like the existing plans, you know, for communications via Afghanistan. It will be already there as an incentive to join in, and in the process to improve regional relations. If this system can be created, then, of course, India will be faced with a situation in which, in the East, India is making determined and extremely expensive attempts to improve its overland communications as part, let's be frank, of its economic and strategic rivalry with China. But India, in the West, will find itself still cut off from Europe and the Middle East and Russia, by Pakistan. Perhaps, though only, of course, if this is backed by a new attitude to India and Pakistan, but perhaps this might create in India too a new attitude to the need for better relations, hopefully for some kind of settlement of differences with Pakistan. I certainly hope that this will be the case in the long run. And as I said, I think that we are actually, after a number of very terrible years, and of course terrorism in Pakistan continues to exact a dreadful toll, but nonetheless, after these very bad years, we are now at a moment of unusual hope for Pakistan. The Pakistani state has survived, contrary once again to some people's predictions, and the Chinese offer gives an opportunity for development, which I very much hope will be successfully seized. Thank you.